An adult male who was seen at a psychiatric unit complained of hearing voices for the past 10 months and loss of appetite. He also complained that he roamed around town, and even though he returned home, he was sometimes physically abusive to his mother and sister. The patient further added that he felt unsafe and thought that people wanted to harm him. Diagnosis: schizophrenia. As medical science advances, what have we learned about the symptoms and treatment of a condition that afflicts more than 20 million people worldwide? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Diane C. Gooding, professor of psychology and psychiatry at the UW-Madison. She's the author of more than 100 internationally published works, and in 2006, she represented the UW-Madison on Capitol Hill when she provided expert testimony on schizophrenia at a congressional hearing on brain disorders. And welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
I suppose if you asked any number of lay people to define schizophrenia, you would have answers that are all over the map. So let's get right down to it and tell us what it is.
Well, I'm going to tell you that it's a severe and persistent mental illness, perhaps one of the most severe. And it affects approximately 1 in 100 people. Now, it is one of the psychotic disorders, and I can tell you later what it is not. But right now, I want to tell you that currently the diagnosis of schizophrenia is made based on symptoms that are inferred from the person's language and behaviors. So unlike something, it's a brain disorder, but unlike something like hypertension or diabetes, we don't have a test for it. We don't have an objective measure. But like hypertension or diabetes, it's a real illness, and that's something that people don't understand. And it's a chronic illness, just like hypertension and diabetes. And it is best treated and managed with medication. It is a lifelong illness as well. So that's very important. It is not because of the way a person was brought up. It's not a fault of the person. It is not something about their spirit or anything like that. They're all kinds of misconceptions. It is an illness. It is a brain disorder. There are treatments for it, but currently there are no cures for it. And we are getting closer to understanding more about it, but we still don't know what causes it or how to prevent it.
Is it something that a person is born with?
We believe so, and I'm going to get into that. It is, at this point, we've come quite a long way from the time of Kraepelin, although even back then in 1896, when he called it dementia praecox, he knew that it was a neurobiological disorder. But unfortunately, by calling it dementia praecox, that implied that it was a neurodegenerative process. And now we conceptualize it as a neurodevelopmental disorder. And when we say that, when you say neurodevelopmental, you're really thinking of it as something that's there from birth. It's a disruption of brain development. So that means that it's there early on, but the brain is not developing normally. So it's occurring early in life, either prenatally or neonatally. Yet when we think of schizophrenia, we think, hey, you know, it starts, the typical age of onset is between 18 and 35.
That late.
So, yes, yes. So what's really happening is that even though it's a disruption of brain development and we can see some signs that something's gone awry early on, the emergence of the psychosis typically does not occur until later on, after relevant brain structures have matured.
Well, if it's a disorder, if it's a structural disorder of some kind, is there any genetic marker for it that we know of?
Now, those are great questions. There are so many signs, and that's a very loaded question. There are signs that we can see. First of all, schizophrenia is a very heterogeneous disorder in terms of how it looks. So there's no one symptom that everyone with schizophrenia must have, which makes it rather complex. And I can talk about that. I can talk about typical symptoms, which I will get into. What are some of the typical symptoms that we see in people with schizophrenia? But when we talk, you just asked about structures and genetics, and I'd love to talk to you about that. When we talk about brain structures, if you look at overall, you can see that there are differences between people on a group level, between people with schizophrenia and those who are typically developing healthy controls. So you'll see things like ventricular enlargement in people with schizophrenia, and ventricles are those spaces through which the cerebral spinal fluid flows. And so obviously if there's enlargement in the ventricles, that means that there's cerebral atrophy because our heads do not expand, right?
Right.
And there's all kinds of other things that we're now discovering, like there's disconnectivity in white matter and so forth. In terms of genes, I want to get into that a little bit later. So please remind me, because I can really talk a lot about that, and I'd like to, because schizophrenia is definitely a genetic disorder, and it's a polygenetic disorder. So if you ask me about that a little bit later, I can go more into detail. I think most people want to know how is it currently defined? Just to start off with, because that's so basic. And how do you know it's schizophrenia as opposed to something like depression, right?
And they can you can have two or three different things along with schizophrenia too, I assume.
You can, but typically you have schizophrenia is the most severe, so we would diagnose that first. Schizophrenia, you can have secondary depression, but we typically talk about schizophrenia being your major disorder.
And so what is our concept of that disorder at this time?
Okay. There are several types of symptoms. There are positive symptoms and negative symptoms. So what do I mean by that? If you think of a number line, where the number zero is in the middle, that represents normality. Then there's a plus sign on the right, which would represent an excess, and the negative sign would represent a deficit. So positive symptoms of schizophrenia are called positive symptoms because there's an excess, there's an exaggeration or a distortion of normal functioning. So there's too much of something. And the positive symptoms of schizophrenia are those things that most people think of when they think of schizophrenia. Delusions or false thoughts, beliefs that people hold on to despite evidence to the contrary. When they think someone is out to get them, or they think that the CIA is out to get them, or someone has implanted something under their skin to track them. Those are delusions of persecution.
Is that the same as paranoia?
It's paranoia, yes. Paranoid delusions. That's the full name for that. And then there are hallucinations, which are another kind of positive symptom. And those are false perceptions. Those are sensations that are not real, that are, they're sensed they're experienced even though there's no real stimulation of the bodily organ. So you might see the person with schizophrenia might see something that's not really there. That's a visual hallucination. Or they might hear something despite stimulation to the ear, the cochlea. That's the auditory hallucination. 74% of people with schizophrenia have auditory hallucinations.
Are they actually, these people actually experiencing something through the brain circuit? For example, if they imagine that somebody is touching them, are they actually having that entire sensation except for the actual initial stimulus?
Yes, and that's known as a tactile hallucination. And there's hallucinations for all five senses, olfactory as well. It's pretty fascinating. And we think there's something known as corollary discharge. So, for example, if you're throwing a baseball, your brain sends a signal. It's called an efferent signal back to, your hand is sending a signal back to your brain saying, hey, I am actually throwing this baseball. And so you know that you are actually executing that motion, and you feel, your motor neurons and everything is telling your brain, hey, I'm actually going ahead with this motion. But there's some disconnect in the brain of someone with schizophrenia, and they might, in fact, throw the ball and then say, wow, why am I throwing this ball? And they will, in fact, then have a delusional belief that somebody else made them throw the ball.
Somebody else made them throw the ball.
And that's a delusion of control, yes. Or they will have, and now because of brain imaging and so forth, it's really fascinating. We have evidence that people, when they're having auditory hallucinations, obviously because this is a great breakthrough, they are thinking that they're hearing the voices outside their head. But what's actually happening is different parts of their brain are lighting up. And the part of the brain where speech is produced is really activated because, indeed, they are active, and also the part that's, different parts, the part that's producing the speech, the part that's comprehending the speech, all these different things are being activated, and they don't realize it.
So if they're hearing somebody speaking to them, they still have to come up with content. And you're saying that that's a different part of brain talking to the actual auditory part of the brain?
Oh, yes. But that's with everyone, right? So there's Broca's area, there's Wernicke's area. That's with everybody. What I'm saying here is that, that's fine for all of us. But what I'm saying is that when a person is having an auditory hallucination of voices talking to them, that's a breakdown of their corollary discharge. And there's no one else there. The voices are being generated internally. But because of the breakdown of that internal monitor, they don't realize that.
It may well be a digression, a diversion, an irrelevancy here, but I'm trying to sort of come to terms with the difference between that kind of hallucination and what's going on in the brain versus a dream.
Well, that's fascinating, too. What the difference is, in a dream, you're not conscious.
Right.
And in a dream, when you wake up, you're like, wow, that was wild. I don't know as much about dreams, but I do know that the neurotransmitter serotonin is very involved in dreams. The neurotransmitters that are implicated in the positive symptoms are most likely dopamine, so it's a little bit different. Although I will say that when people do, when people use stimulant drugs and hallucinogenics, they also have that dreamlike experience, and they may hallucinate.
How would we recognize schizophrenia if we were just to, spend an afternoon with someone or be at a party with them or some social function or even, you know, be alone with them? How would we, what would be the signs that we would start to see?
Well, they might show these positive symptoms of delusions, these false beliefs, the hallucinations. They might tell you that they're seeing things, and they might ask you for some reality testing. Hey, do you see that? Do you hear those people talking about me? Or they might show disorganized thoughts, speech, and behavior. So disorganized thoughts are often called formal thought disorder. And that's one of the things that people notice the most. Formal thought disorder is kind of a fragmentation of the logical, progressive, and goal-directed nature of normal thought processes. That can vary in severity from talking in a roundabout way, which we call circumstantiality, or someone being tangential, to more severe incoherence and, frankly, word salad. So sometimes if you're trying to talk to someone. Now, you might not see them at a party, and that's what I'm going to get into, the negative symptoms. You're more likely to see them, maybe a homeless person. 33% of our homeless people have severe and persistent mental illness. And also the negative symptoms of schizophrenia, which I'll talk about now, are called negative because there's a deficit. There's an absence or a diminished amount of normal functioning. And one of those negative symptoms, one that I'm particularly keen on studying, is anhedonia.
Anhedonia.
Anhedonia is a lack of pleasure. And I'm really interested in social anhedonia. So the reason I say you won't see them in a party is they don't enjoy being around other people as much. And because of that, they're less likely to be in a social gathering. Okay?
Right.
So this is something that we see this throughout the developmental course. In fact, there are signs suggesting that social anhedonia, the inability to derive pleasure from being around other people, is something that actually may be a risk factor for schizophrenia. So in childhood, the school-aged children who later develop schizophrenia display social difficulties. During adolescence, those individuals who are later diagnosed with schizophrenia prefer to be alone, and they have difficulty connecting with others. And then even there's a really interesting study of Israeli army conscripts, and the ones who were had early discharge and didn't make it through. They did a study of them, and they had social difficulties, among other things like intellectual, lower IQ scores and things like that. So again, the social anhedonia seems to be something that is characteristic of a lot of people with schizophrenia. And that's just one of the negative symptoms. Here's another one. Affect, lack of or flat affect or blunted affect, that's a lack of expressivity. So they might not be showing a lot of gestures, hand gestures or prosody in their voice, lack of expressivity.
What about emotional range? Would they be less likely to laugh? Less
yes,
likely to respond
probably.
Emotionally?
Yeah, they just, sometimes people say it's like talking to a statue. That's a very extreme example. But that's really interesting. I think it might have a neurological substrate because, interestingly enough, when you talk to a person with schizophrenia subjectively, they may be feeling the affect, but they're not able to display it.
Oh, so yeah, that's a disconnect. Sure.
Yeah. And that is why, in fact, Bleuler changed the name of schizophrenia from dementia praecox to schizophrenia, because schizophrenia, the name means splitting of the mind.
Yeah, and I think it's really easy for a layperson to think schizophrenia, oh, that means like some kind of split personality.
Right, but it doesn't. It means splitting of the mind's functions. And you can see that split in the disconnect between the emotion and the feeling and the display of emotion, or that corollary discharge that, you know, what one part of the brain is doing and what the, you know, and what the other part is aware of, that awareness. Another negative symptom would be avolition. And what that means is a lack of motivation. And that avolition is revealed by poor grooming or hygiene, physical lack of energy, where the person can't keep at their task, whether it's at school or, you know, school functioning declines, work functioning declines, or even something recreational. Like you'll see an 18-year-old who just can't play hacky sack anymore. It's not laziness. They're having severe negative symptoms. And we typically see schizophrenia emerging between, you know, late high school, early first year, second year of college. And so these are the kinds of things that we see.
What's the brain doing at that stage of life that these things would become manifest?
That's a great question. The brain is, I can describe it in a couple ways, but briefly, the brain is finally some of the last regions to develop are coming online, like the frontal lobes, especially the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. So actually, the frontal cortex doesn't finish developing until around 24, 25. And so that's when, you know, males, their age of onset's a little earlier than females, but around 18 to 25 is when you'll see the typical age of onset for males. And what's so interesting is if you look at this neurologically, there's several things that are going on. And this gets back, this harkens back to kind of a neurodevelopmental perspective on schizophrenia. So
sure.
If you think about what's going on in the brain, let's look at the stages of neurodevelopment for a minute, okay? So let's just take a step back and you think, okay, first the cells are forming when you're like a little neonate, prenatally the cells are forming, and then when you're a neonate, they're migrating and all that good stuff. And then there's this huge proliferation of dendrites and spines. And these are parts of the neuron that are just like the little branches.
The developing networks.
Yes, exactly. And then there's a growth spurt of synapses called synaptogenesis. And then there's myelination around the time of puberty. And then there's the necessary pruning of excess synapses. And finally, there's programmed cell death, and there's a fancy name for it, apoptosis.
Okay.
And, yeah. And neurally, we can think of all of this happening, and it's very kind of experience expectant, and there are certain things that need to happen at certain times. And what we think is happening is, of course, myelination is important, but we have to wait until certain structures come online and they mature. And the frontal lobes are really entering that final push around, you know, the 20s, the early 20s. And so that's when reasoning and good judgment finally come about.
Oh, boy, that explains a lot of those fraternity parties.
Oh, yeah. And it explains a lot. And you can really see it, you know, as a professor, I really love it because you really see that differential maturation from freshman year really through the years. By the time they're seniors, so different.
You know, it's interesting that talking of etymology a little bit, the word sophomore means wise fool. And, you know, it's a very old word, but there was some wisdom in that label, wasn't there?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's delightful to see how the students change.
Well, let's look further at the aspects of schizophrenia, how you can recognize it, and we've hinted a little bit at treatments, but we'll get farther into that and also into the genetics of schizophrenia when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Dr. Diane C. Gooding, Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry at the UW-Madison, and we're talking about schizophrenia. And a ways back, Diane, you promised to tell us something about the genetics of schizophrenia, and that might be a key to how we could see some early signs or predict who would develop it?
Yes. Well, the genetics of schizophrenia are really interesting because we know that schizophrenia is polygenetic. That means that multiple genes are involved in the disorder. So at this point, I can tell you that schizophrenia is a polygenetic disorder of neurodevelopmental origins. What I cannot tell you right now is what genes in particular are involved. There's still a huge search to find out. This has been something that we've all been really searching for quite a while. But lots of family, twin, adoption studies, and now more recently, some more complicated types of genetic studies, genome-wide association studies and so forth, have now shown us that what is inherited is not the disease itself. So you don't inherit schizophrenia. What you inherit, rather, are the genes that confer risk for schizophrenia. And I want to repeat that because it's such a key point. The thing that determines a person's risk for schizophrenia is really one's genetic relatedness to a person with schizophrenia. That is how many genes they have in common. Not how close they live to someone with schizophrenia, not whether they were raised together, not whether, you know, that kind of thing. So, for example, being an identical twin of a person with schizophrenia, and we call this being a monozygotic twin, sharing 100% genetic overlap. That renders you at greater risk for the later development of schizophrenia.
What kind of risk factor is that for a genetic twin with schizophrenia that the other twin, identical twin, would have it?
Okay, well, there's two kinds of twins. Okay, you can be monozygotic,
right,
which means you have 100% genetic overlap, or you can be dizygotic, which means 50% genetic overlap. And so you have 50% of your genes in common. Now, dizygotic twins are really just as similar to each other as regular siblings. Just, you know,
right.
The difference is that dizygotic twins are just born at the same time. So if you look at it that way, they're just because of their shared environment and a lot of other things, and being treated more similarly because they were born at the same time, they do have a little bit more of a shared risk than typical siblings. However,
but with monozygotic is going to be 100%.
Monozygotic twins are going to be a much higher risk. So if you consider that a person in the general population is, you know, let's say they have a 1% risk, so that's 1 in 100 has, you know, schizophrenia, then a person on average with a monozygotic co-twin would be about 46 times more likely.
So
that's
sense.
Quite a lot.
Yeah.
And what's so fascinating is that there have been studies of what we call MZAs, monozygotic twins reared apart. So you don't even have to be you know, raised with monozygotic co-twin.
Yeah, we hear about that.
Yeah, it's pretty rare, but it happens. And now here is one of my all-time favorite studies. It is Gottesman and Bertelsen, and it was done a while ago, and it's so rare, but it's so cool. They studied the offspring of two types of twins, the offspring of monozygotic twins, discordant for schizophrenia. So, I mean, that's really interesting. So monozygotic twins, where one of the twins was diagnosed with schizophrenia and the other one was not, despite being 100% genetically identical, and compared them to dizygotic twins, discordant for schizophrenia, meaning that one of them had schizophrenia and the other one did not.
Right.
But they studied their offspring. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, the dizygotic twins who were discordant, they looked at their offspring, and not surprisingly, the offspring of the dizygotic twins who did not have schizophrenia, their risk for schizophrenia was really not that much higher than the general population.
Okay.
And the offspring of the dizygotic twin with schizophrenia was, you know, that offspring was at heightened risk. Of course, they had a parent with schizophrenia. Now, if you look, what was really fascinating was to look at the twins, the offspring of the monozygotic twins. Even though they were discordant for schizophrenia, the risk to the offspring of developing schizophrenia was nearly identical. It was 16.8%. I can't believe I have this memorized versus 17.4%. It was a non-significant difference. And they were both really heightened. And what that showed us, I teach this to my students every year. It's like one of my favorite studies, because what it shows us is that what is inherited is not schizophrenia itself, but rather the genes conferring risk. So even the monozygotic twin who was discordant, who did not in themselves manifest schizophrenia, so their phenotype, what's observable, did not show schizophrenia. Their genotype still had schizophrenia risk, and that was what was transmitted to their offspring.
So their risk is not any greater, but they just have those, it's almost like a kind of, silent component of their future, I guess you could say.
Exactly, exactly.
It's a switch that's not turned on.
It did not turn on in them, but it was there, and it was transmitted to the offspring.
And what sense do we have then when those offspring have children? But if they have children
would be second degree relatives, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. So the offspring of people with schizophrenia are clearly at a higher risk for schizophrenia than the general population. On average, they're about 10 times more likely to develop schizophrenia over the course of their lifetime. On the other hand, if you're the grandchild of a person with schizophrenia, you're only 5 times more likely to develop schizophrenia. So as you can see, if you're an offspring, you're a first-degree relative. If you're a grandchild, you're a second-degree relative. So it has to do with the amount of genetic overlap and the amount of genetic relatedness.
You're diluting it after a few generations.
Exactly. So I often have people who I don't even know, but they're on campus and they'll email me and say, you know, I've got a relative, X, Y, and Z, who has schizophrenia. Can I come to your office hours and talk to you about my risk for schizophrenia? And I always say yes. And then I explain to them, you know, you are a first or a second degree or even a third degree relative of a person with schizophrenia. Here is your risk. It may be somewhat higher, but that just, you know, it's a diathesis stress model. It just means that you have a higher vulnerability. And now I'll explain what that means. But it doesn't mean you're going to get it. It simply means you have a vulnerability, but we all have a vulnerability. It just means how much higher is it? Because a diathesis, if you think about a diathesis stress conceptualization, we're all somewhere on that continuum. And yes. It goes from low to high, but you still need, but having the genes is significant but not sufficient to develop schizophrenia. You must have some stressors.
Something that'll trigger those genes.
Yes, yes.
You mentioned earlier, Diane, that there is no cure for schizophrenia.
Right.
And I assume then we're also not at the stage where we can go in and do the DNA tinkering that would remove
right.
those risk
right.
factors.
Well, I wanted to say a couple of things more about the genetics, and then I'll talk to you a little bit more about that because we're getting closer, actually. So there are some, because I said that schizophrenia is heterogeneous, there's a couple of cases. They're very rare, but they're known as copy number variations. And maybe in about 100 people with schizophrenia, there might be 1 to 3 people with schizophrenia who this applies to, but they're still interesting enough because for those people, it's relevant. And it's a strong risk factor for them genetically. A copy number variation is where you have a variation in your number of chromosomes your number of deletions or, there's something going on your gene. Your chromosomes are the same, I should say, but on the chromosome, there's something different going on. So some copy number variations are deletions, like 22q11. There's like a little piece that's missing on that chromosome 22, or what's the other one? 15q. I know 22q11 really well because that's the one that we mostly look at.
What does 22q11 do?
There's a deletion on it, and people with that deletion either develop schizophrenia or they can develop another psychotic disorder, typically mostly schizophrenia, sometimes bipolar disorder. And they have, it's also called velocardiofacial syndrome, and they can have, it's got variable expressivity, meaning that there can be different expressions of the same genotype, and something called reduced penetrance, which means that the genotype is not always expressed as the same as a full-blown disease. So some people can have intellectual disability along with psychiatric problems, and other people have very mild cases, which we hope for because 22q11 has some very serious cardiac problems with it as well. So that's the one that I've really followed up a lot more.
Yeah, sounds powerful.
There's also 15q13, and there's another one on chromosome number 1.
So we can recognize these.
Yes, you can. So actually going back to your original question, can we ever tell? You can sometimes tell from the facial features. If someone has 22q11, you don't know if they have schizophrenia or not. And there's also a duplication, and that one is 16p11. Now, what's really interesting is the CNVs, we see them in other neurodevelopmental disorders as well. That's really interesting. That was a tangent a little bit, but you were asking about genetics, and so I got all excited about that.
Yeah, I'd call it a sidebar. it all fits.
But when you talk about genes, here's another thing, and that I think is really interesting, and it gets back into the whole thing about age as well. You were talking about the 18 to 25-year-olds and risk factors for schizophrenia. And I just have to say that cannabis use during adolescence is associated with heightened risk for psychosis.
Wow.
And yes, and most people don't know that. And it's, well, psychosis in general, but especially schizophrenia. And this was something that, if you're a schizophrenia researcher, you've known this for a while, but not enough people know this. And there's something called, and when you said genes, I was just like, oh, I should say this. There's something called a GE interaction, gene by environment interaction. And a GE interaction, gene by environment interaction, means that it's a genetically influenced sensitivity to the environment. So some individuals are more vulnerable to a given environmental stress factor than others based on their gene, their genotype, their genetic makeup. So there's a gene-environment interaction because only some people with a specific genetic variation who use cannabis will be at a heightened risk. But you just triggered me to talk about it because you said, well, is there a way that we can go around giving a test to see who's at risk for schizophrenia? We don't even have a test right now to see. I mean, most of us don't walk around going, hi, can you test my COMT gene to see what my polymorphism is? Because that is actually the gene that if you have a Val or Val-Met polymorphism and you use cannabis between the ages of, I think it's like 12 and 20, you are at heightened risk, you know, for the development. And it's been proven, it's been demonstrated, and it's been replicated now. And the first group that showed that was a group led by Avshalom Caspi and Terry Moffitt in 2005. And it was written up in Biological Psychiatry. And, you know, it was kind of interesting because it has been argued and people, I mean, I know this is a little controversial because, of course, everyone's legalizing cannabis all over the place.
Yes.
And I'm like, hey, wait a second. Do you realize what we're doing?
And that that age group is going to be one of the lead users, I would guess.
Exactly. And so, you know, as a schizophrenia researcher, I'm very concerned about that.
I'm surprised that hasn't been in the press.
I wonder about that. Those of us in the field kind of wonder about that, too.
Well, that's fascinating. It will be interesting to see if we do start seeing it as the discussions continue. Although, as you say, it's already been legalized in a number of states. Let's look further at these aspects of schizophrenia and dispel some of the myths about it, too. It does turn up a lot in the media, and we'll look at some of the advice and where to get help if you or someone you know may have schizophrenia. All of that when we return shortly. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Diane C. Gooding, professor of psychology and psychiatry at the UW-Madison, and we're talking about schizophrenia. And what about some of the early signs? We've touched on this just a little bit, but early signs that would help you to recognize someone with schizophrenia?
Yes. That's a great question. So on an individual level, we're still really diagnosing and looking at phenotypes, those observable signs and symptoms. We don't have a blood test that we can administer or a brain scan that we can tell a person, yes, you have schizophrenia. So there are some encroaching signs of incipient breakdowns in reality. These are warning signs that something's going on. We call them prodromal signs. That term comes from the field of medicine. There may be a progression in the person's decline in functioning as they progress from early prodromal indicators, which can be typically nonspecific things, and then there can be attenuated or watered down kind of negative symptoms, and I describe the negative symptoms. And that can be a cause for concern, naturally. And then they are treated differently from the later prodromal indicators, which the later prodromal indicators are typically attenuated positive symptoms. So I want to talk to you, I want to just give you a list of symptoms in case you see these. And the nonspecific symptoms would be depression, and I'm warning you, they're very nonspecific. Depression, anxiety, sleep disturbance, changes in hygiene, problems with concentration and attention, and problems with stress tolerance.
Sounds like a teenager to me.
I was going to say, granted, they sound like your typical adolescent, but it's when you see a change, a real decline. And yeah, you might just go, what's going on with my teenager? But that's when you just kind of look at them a little bit, and maybe, you know, maybe therapy might be warranted. But when you see the attenuated negative symptoms, which often precede the attenuated positive symptoms. And what do I mean by attenuated negative symptoms? Well, I've already described the negative symptoms, but the attenuated negative symptoms are socially isolating itself. Decreased motivation, less emotionality, like less looking kind of flat, decreased emotional responsiveness, not enjoying things that they usually enjoyed, problems with abstract thinking, a decline in school or work functioning, okay? In a lot of, when I do longitudinal kind of diagnoses of patients, a lot of time, the first symptoms we see in people that end up being diagnosed with schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder, which is a related disorder, is depression. So don't just say, oh, they're depressed. Look into it. And then the attenuated positive symptoms are things like changes in thought content, distrustfulness. That's like a precursor to paranoia. Perceptual changes, confused or inconsistent speech, ideas of reference, you know, those are the things. Now, we cannot predict with certainty who will develop schizophrenia, but we can say that these are things that really point out that there might be some difficulty and something might be happening.
Is there any kind of bell curve as to a point in life when a person is more or less likely to develop schizophrenia? I mean, can it develop in a 50-year-old or a 60-year-old?
You know, it's interesting. There is late-life psychosis, but it is somewhat different from schizophrenia. Between the ages of 18 and 35 are the typical ages of onset, with females being a little bit later, 25 to 35 for females. So when I hit my 40th birthday, one of my favorite schizophrenia researchers sent me a birthday card saying, congratulations, you've used up most of your lifetime risk for schizophrenia.
There's got to be a good side, right?
Yeah, right. You know, only a schizophrenia researcher would, you know, kind of see that kind of humor. We do use a lot of endophenotypes, which is a marker, which is intermediate between genetic factors that cannot be seen by the naked eye and the phenotypes, which are those things that are observable. And those endophenotypes are useful because they help us to identify people who are at heightened risk for the later development. And an example of an endophenotype might be an impairment on a cognitive test, like working memory, which is the ability to hold information online. Like, you know, backwards, digits span backwards. And these are things that you can go and get a neurocognitive battery, and it's usually included in that. Or I do endophenotype, I do testing with smooth pursuit eye tracking and anti-saccade task deficits. Those are the kinds of things that we're doing experimentally, and that's been really helpful. I also use personality characteristics that are similar to those shown by people diagnosed with schizophrenia, such as social anhedonia, which I've described earlier.
Yeah. Do we have enough data to indicate whether or not there's an increased incidence of schizophrenia per capita?
You know, interestingly enough, it's still about 1%. And that's probably a good thing because it's such a severe disorder.
Well, leave us with some hope here, Diane. You know, we haven't really talked at all about treatment. You did say earlier there's no cure for schizophrenia, but is there a way to alleviate it, a way to cope with it? And how, as a family member or as a sufferer, would you cope with it? What would be your hope?
Well, you know, first of all, the treatments they're not perfect by any means. I would not lie to you and say that they're perfect, but there have been some improvements. You know, for the longest time, there are only the first-generation antipsychotics like Haldol and Thorazine and Prolixin, and now we've got the second-generation antipsychotics, which are affecting other neurotransmitter systems in addition to dopamine. And we know from some treatment studies that it's important to integrate psychosocial interventions along with medication and do some vocational rehabilitation, and that's good. We know that people with schizophrenia like to work and can, you know, contribute meaningfully to our community and our society, just like everyone else. And we've got more clubhouse models, more assertive community treatment, and all those things are really, really good. We know that there's a lot of ongoing research on the topic of schizophrenia, and that's good. We know that people with the lived experience of schizophrenia are getting more involved as collaborators with us in this research. That's very helpful. And we know that we're all in a partnership to destigmatize schizophrenia. And the most important thing I would say is that there can be recovery in various ways. You can define recovery as a reduction in the number of hospitalizations or the number of relapses, those kind of things. But I would like to encourage mental health professionals and researchers and family members to take more of a patient-oriented perspective and to define recovery as achieving an improvement in one's quality of life, having a positive sense of oneself in spite of one's symptoms. Maybe you're not going to get rid of all your symptoms, but still obtaining a fulfilling, meaningful life, because I know people with schizophrenia who have done that. And those are my heroes. And I think it's so important to have hope. And that's an essential component of the recovery process for all of us, all individuals with schizophrenia. And you can get help. There's SARDA, which is the Schizophrenia and Related Disorders Alliance of America. There's NAMI, the National Alliance for Mental Illness. There's SIRS, the Schizophrenia International Research Society. There's lots of places that are committed to ameliorating the treatment and the condition of schizophrenia. For family members, I'd say educate yourself about schizophrenia. Medication adherence is important. I would say to people with schizophrenia, make sure that you work on your social support networks, have hope, and for everyone whose lives are affected by schizophrenia, either directly or indirectly, be gentle with yourself.
That's a good rule for almost anybody, isn't it? Be gentle with yourself.
Yes, it is. And I would say to the general public, remember that these are people first, people with schizophrenia. And like everybody else, everybody wants to be treated with dignity and respect, and we all have the same need to be valued.
There's a lot more we could have gotten into with this subject of schizophrenia, but perhaps for another time. My guess
is I would love it.
As would I. My guest has been Dr. Diane Gooding, professor of psychology and psychiatry at the UW-Madison, and it has been a pleasure.
Thank you.
I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.